The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
This is a good day, because once again we're seeing what's possible with strong American diplomacy.
That's what President Obama had to say on January the 17th, the day after Implementation Day, the day America implemented its nuclear deal with Iran. And then just this week, from the U.S. State Department, it issued a travel advisory on Monday for Americans traveling to Iran, and this was intended to replace the travel warning from earlier in the year, back in March. The State Department says here it reiterates and highlights the risk of arrest and detention of U.S. citizens. It says foreigners, this is from the State Department release just on Monday, foreigners in particular, dual nationals of Iran and Western countries, including the United States, continue to be detained or prevented from leaving Iran. U.S. citizens traveling to Iran should very carefully weigh the risks of travel, as we now know, associated with that implementation day. You had the exchange of prisoners, 7-for-4, I believe it was. And then now added to that, secretive cash payment that wasn't a ransom. It was just a little bit of leverage, because a standard U.S. policy is that we don't pay ransom for U.S. hostages. Well, coming back to this State Department announcement from Monday, it says Iranian authorities continue to unjustly detain and imprison U.S. citizens, particularly Iranian Americans, including students, journalists, business travelers, and academics, on charges including espionage and posing a threat to national security. It says Iranian authorities have also prevented the departure, in some cases for months, of a number of Iranian American citizens who traveled to Iran for personal or professional reasons. U.S. citizens traveling to Iran should very carefully weigh the risks of travel and consider postponing their travel. That's the latest warning coming from the State Department just after all of these revelations from a couple of weeks ago, and then more of it even last week when the State Department finally admitted, well, yes, you know, we did hold off on the cash payment until after we knew those prisoners were going to be released. The State Department knows the way the rest of this world reads the deal. The State Department knows the way Iran is viewing this deal for the hostages, this shameful deal. There's so many details that have emerged. I can remember earlier in the year, now this is more with respect to Britain's response, but someone talking about a banner that was there, I believe, in the Birmingham airport about travel opportunities to Iran now that this nuke deal has gone through, and well, there's good opportunities to expand our travel. And now you have these warnings, particularly from America, as they know, with all these deals, or rather these details coming out, they know the way America's enemies are reading this. What a precedent that was set back in January. The same day the president made this announcement. This is a good day, really, to give them 7 criminals in return for these 4 American innocents, and then $400 million on top of that. I just want to take you back to what was reported in and around the 17th of January. Of course, this was the time when no one knew about the $400 million, or at least that it was used as leverage, to quote the State Department, or as a ransom, to be more precise. This is before anyone knew this. even if some suspected it. The New York Times says for a year. It's talking about the ongoing negotiations for the release of these prisoners. This is from January the 17th. For a year, the Obama administration or Obama administration officials had been meeting in secret with Iranian counterparts seeking to free the Americans imprisoned in the Islamic Republic. Finally, it says, last fall, a deal for the prisoner release seemed all but sealed. So this would have been in the fall of 2015. And then to quote the Times, it says, but the Iranians arrived at the last clandestine session in a Geneva hotel suite with a whole new proposal that insisted on the release of dozens of Iranians held in American prisons. So going in, I mean, the negotiations were almost final as part of the nuke deal. And then they come in to the final meeting and they say, hold on a second. We want you to give us some Iranian hostages. Dozens of them, in fact. The Times says here the Americans were flabbergasted. We've already talked about this, said Ben McGurk, the lead negotiator, but the Iranians were adamant, according to American officials informed about the meeting. Something back home had changed. Speaking of Iran, part of the continuing battle inside Iran over how to deal with the United States. Someone in power in Tehran, it seemed, did not want the deal after all. And so Mr. McGurk and his team picked up their papers and walked out, putting an abrupt end to the meeting. Mr. McGurk, his interlocutors, it said, had come from Iran's state security apparatus, a group that had barely, if ever, met Americans, much less negotiated with them. They didn't have the well-traveled English-speaking demeanor of the two senior Iranians who had been negotiating the larger nuclear deal with the U.S. for more than 2 years. Well, the story explains here that the talks were resumed. It took the Secretary of State, John Kerry, to get things off and running again, along with his counterpart, Mohammad Zarif. And then in the end, those four Americans were finally let go or released. In exchange, this is as reported by the New York Times on January 17th, in exchange for 7 Iranians freed by the United States. So you have a lopsided prisoner swap, these 7 Iranian criminals, for the 4 Americans detained for no good reason, imprisoned for no good reason, imprisoned on trumped-up charges. That happened on January 17th. That happened the day after Implementation Day. That happened the same day that President Obama came forward and said, this is a good day. I mean, we're seeing what's possible with strong American diplomacy. Look at what we've accomplished. He went on and explained in that same quote that, well, we've had years and years of animosity and hostility where we haven't been able to talk. And my administration has broken through. Very proud of what they had accomplished. And now look at all the shameful details that we're learning about this deal, about the prisoner swap, about the cash in all of the foreign currencies. Going back to this New York Times piece, January 17th, it says the Iranians were not the only ones grappling with divisions in their government about a possible deal. The Obama administration was engaged in a vigorous debate about whether to trade Iranian prisoners, and if so, which ones, with Attorney General Loretta Lynch objecting to any deal that equated innocent Americans seized for political gain with Iranian criminals indicted or convicted under Western legal traditions. I mean, even Loretta Lynch was saying this is bad for us. This is a bad precedent to exchange criminals for Americans that were just seized for political gain. Kidnapped, in other words. Kidnapped. Held for ransom. I mean, just the fact that we gave them 7 criminals, that right there violated the no ransom policy. The president, you'll recall, we played this for you on Friday. He came out 2 weeks ago once this first report from the Wall Street Journal came out that $400 million was a ransom payment Well, even if you leave aside the cash, to give them seven criminals for four Americans seized for political gain, that's a ransom payment. The New York Times says, in the end, officials said President Obama decided that to spare the American years. So Loretta Lynch protested, and the president overrode that protest. Officials said President Obama decided that to spare the Americans years, if not life, in an Iranian prison, he would make what he called a one-time gesture. That's in a quote, one-time gesture, close quote. By releasing Iranians who had been accused or convicted of violating sanctions that he was lifting anyway as part of the nuclear agreement. So this was just a one-time gesture, giving them these seven criminals that we now know included $400 million. All of those pallets stuffed with Swiss francs and euros and other foreign currencies. And the reason for that, of course, is because U.S. law forbids any transaction with Iran in U.S. dollars. And so this administration, almost like a mafia organization, goes and gets all of these other bills, these other foreign currencies, to get this deal done. But don't worry, it's just a one-time arrangement. The Wall Street Journal reported the same thing. This is a one-time arrangement, said a second U.S. official, describing the prisoner swap. It's not a precedent for the future. Don't get this confused with precedent. It's a one-time deal. It's a one-time gesture. And of course, you can look into the dictionary and see what the definition there is for precedent. It's any act, decision, or case that serves as a guide or justification for subsequent situations. And that's, of course, the way America's enemies will see it. Well, this is precedent. This is an act that will serve as a guide or justification for subsequent situations. And so that's why we have this new warning issued by the State Department that you better not travel to Iran, because you know what they do? They kidnap you for political gain. And you're going to be held sometimes for months, maybe years, until they get what in return? Well, maybe some Iranian hostages, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. You look at the timeline here. The shameful capitulation on January 16th, a nuclear deal that, as we also now know, was made under a deceitful cloud. It was finalized after an elaborate propaganda campaign. That's what the Obama administration has since admitted. Ben Rhodes. Yeah, it was propaganda. We did lie. We're proud of it. Did you know that 2 months before that deal was made final in January? I read this to you, I believe, yesterday. That in his meeting with Russian officials, the Iranian Ayatollah told Vladimir Putin that America's long-term scheme for the region is detrimental to all nations and countries. It's detrimental to every nation in the world, in other words, particularly Iran and Russia, and it should be thwarted through vigilance and closer interaction. We've got to come together, Russia, because what America's doing in this region, it's detrimental to all nations on earth. America's the problem. America's the enemy. America's the one that we have to get out of the Middle East. That was 2 months before the deal was finalized, January 16th, 2016. That was implementation day. Coming right after the Ayatollah said, look, we've got to work together to defeat America. And then, of course, you know all about the detainment of those sailors, the illegal detainment of those sailors. What was that, January 12th? Just a few days before implementation day? Those sailors held at gunpoint, publicly humiliated, forced to apologize, and an administration that, according to Reuters, was doing everything it could to keep that incident under wraps, or at least to keep it under wraps until after the President's State of the Union address was concluded that night, January 12th. So you had that public humiliation. You had that public apology. Then you have the lopsided prisoner swap the day after implementation day. 7 Iranian criminals exchanged for 4 Americans held up on trumped-up charges, sold to the American public with the tagline that this is just a one-time thing. Don't think that this means we're going to pay ransom for U.S. prisoners abroad. This is not a precedent for the future, they said. And now we know that the $400 million in foreign currencies was indeed shipped to Iran as part of the deal. It's not a ransom, the State Department says. It was just money held as leverage. It's not a ransom, the State Department says. And then a few days later, well, Americans, you better be wary of traveling to Iran because they've been known to kidnap Americans. You see what's happening here. What a year this has been. And as my father has said recently, well, it's as if all these events keep taking us back to that shameful deal that was finalized on January the 16th, 2016, 30 years to the day after Herbert W. Armstrong's death. Let me play for you one more clip from the president's statement on January 17th.
So the bottom line is this. Whereas Iran was steadily expanding its nuclear program, we have now cut off every single path that Iran could have used to build a bomb.
We've now cut off every single path that they could have used to build the bomb. Now, given what has happened since he made that statement, all of the lies, the ransom payment, Iran illegally firing ballistic missiles, Iran kidnapping more Americans, the State Department's latest warning, and on and on and on we could go. Does anyone really believe what the president said there? And moreover, what will he say, or what will his spokespeople say? When, just like with North Korea, 12 years after President Clinton gave us those same assurances, they start firing away, testing nuclear bombs. What will this administration say then when the inevitable happens? Once, this is my, or not my father's article, this is actually from Joel Hilliker. He wrote this in July. He said, once Iran's seized assets are released and sanctions start to come off, once oil money again starts flowing into Iran, watch what happens. You watch. Just watch what happens. Not even economic hardship was able to dissuade the regime from its radical goals. That's an important point to make here. Before they had the money, before all of these sanctions, or rather during these sanctions, when they were being crippled economically, they still were the number one state sponsor of terror. They still vowed to wipe Israel off the map. They still saw the United States as the great Satan. He says here, with even the threat of economic punishment withdrawn, it's certain to act with even greater assertiveness and pushiness. Well, now they've got money. Now they've got cash flowing in right and left. Now they've got precedent for kidnapping more Americans. That's another moneymaker for them. What you can expect, you watch what happens, as Mr. Hilliker wrote there, is more pushiness. That's what we can expect. That's obvious. That's obvious what will happen. This is from the Wall Street Journal. I believe it is, just from today. It says, it's not clear how much worse things will get for the Obama administration over the $400 million payment to Iran in January, but the cash for prisoners scandal may end up being the least of U.S. concerns in all of this. I mean, what's the larger concern here? It says here, here's the larger and more potentially damaging perception beyond the general embarrassment. Right now, well, that's just the way the administration views this. It's embarrassing, and we'll kind of keep quiet and come back from our vacations and just kind of ignore it. And the press won't hold them responsible or accountable for it. So they'll move on. They'll move on. There's a little bit of a coverage, like when Ben Rhodes admitted that they lied about it in May. And then just a few weeks after that, the New York Times went and printed some of the lies he admitted to, as if they were facts. The narrative's not going to change. Here's the larger, more potentially damaging perception. In the Middle East, strength and negotiating acumen are prized. They demonstrate power and credibility. And the region tends to consider actions and strategy in a time frame that stretches far beyond the 4 and 8 year scale of U.S. politics. That's the thing. I'm sure there's some in the Obama administration that are right now saying, well, you know, we need to get 2-3 more months down the road. Then we're out, and then it's over to the next administration. But that's not the way other nations think. They think longer term. China, Russia, Iran. It says here, meanwhile, the Obama administration's handling of Iran in this situation plays into the narrative that the U.S. is weak and feckless and behaving as if it doesn't know what it's doing. That's the way the other nations, the enemies of America, that's the way they see this. That's the way they view this. America's weak and feckless, and they don't know what they're doing. It says here, some will see this as proof that the U.S. is unable or unwilling to contain Iran's influence in the region, whether because the administration fears that pushing the Iranians too hard on Syria might jeopardize the international agreement over Tehran's nuclear program, a seminal achievement for Mr. Obama, or because the U.S. is wary of deeper involvement in the region. Others will notice that Iran is cementing ties with its friends, Russia, Turkey, Hezbollah, Iraqi militias that support Iran, and the Assad regime, while the U.S. is losing regional clout by becoming estranged from its friends, notably Israel and Saudi Arabia, also because of the nuclear accord. And that bit at the start there, we went all through that yesterday. Iran cementing its ties with Russia, Turkey, Hezbollah, and so on. Finally, it says here, meanwhile, the administration is tripping over itself, trying to explain how and why it didn't pay ransom, as Iranian hardliners contend that that is precisely what happened. That's precisely what happened. Of course it was ransom. Of course it was a payment made for prisoners. I mean, the two planes took off at the same time. It says here, all of this feeds into an image of U.S. policy fundamentally constrained by a changing region, one that seems beyond Washington's willingness and capacity to manage. The central actor in this new landscape is a rising Iran, willing to sacrifice much for its vital interests. That's the central actor here. A rising Iran. The Ayatollah, as I said on Monday's program, he's come through all of this as the big victor. He's the real winner here. And for those that thought, well, never mind even if it is propaganda, and even if it is a ransom payment, the thing that this is going to do, some must have thought, the thing that it will do is it will weaken the Ayatollah. It'll weaken the regime, and it'll give power and strength and encouragement to the so-called moderates. Hasn't happened. It says here, what can be hard to keep in mind in all the back and forth is that Iran isn't 10 feet tall. Its regime has its own constraints in Syria and Iraq, but in a region of weak Arab states alongside a Russia willing to assert its power, and a Washington constrained by a nuclear accord that has expanded Iran's ambitions, Tehran is a force to be reckoned with. I mean, it's not like Tehran doesn't have any weaknesses, he's saying. But because of all of these factors, a weak America, the assistance of Russia, the flow of all this money after the lifting of sanctions, well, Tehran is now a force to be reckoned with. And as we would add to that, it's the biblically prophesied king of the South. It's the head of that radical Islamist snake, through and through. The Wall Street Journal, finally, it says here, this will be the case even more when the constraints on its nuclear program begin to sunset in a few years, at which point cash for prisoners may end up being the least of U.S. concerns. In other words, let's not forget about what's at the heart of this nuclear deal. It buys America a few years, and of course, as others have pointed out, that's just giving Iran the benefit of the doubt, assuming they won't violate the terms of the deal. In fact, they're already doing it. But under the best case scenario for the United States, all that the deal ever did was buy it a few years. Well, we're almost a year into it now. And look at the details that have emerged. The propaganda, the lies, the firing of ballistic missiles, the 100,000 Iranians in Iraq, the support for the Assad regime, the alliance with Russia, Russian aircraft taking off last week from an Iranian base. Iran is becoming very pushy, just as it's prophesied to be in Daniel 11 and verse 40. What's astounding, really, is that we identified Iran as the king of the south back in 1994. That was 22 years ago. And no one would have identified Iran as a force to be reckoned with across the Middle East. No one. And now look. It's king. The United States is gone. And you have the king there. What a force. My father wrote in a personal, this is actually in a forthcoming personal, it's not going to be out until the October issue of the Trumpet magazine, but he writes about this deal, the hostage deal, that we learned about on January 17th and that we now know a lot about from more recent reporting by the Wall Street Journal and others. But he says in this article how, you know, the fact that all of this is happening in and around January the 16th, that serves as a great warning to America, because when you think about all these latter-day prophecies that are unfolding before our eyes, God gave those prophecies meaning when Herbert Armstrong was out serving him for decades. God opened his mind to understand these great many prophecies of God. Now we see them being fulfilled. And as this personal brings out, I mean, you can go down right down the list of all these major events that have happened over the years. Right on that anniversary of Herbert Armstrong's death, or right near it, my father says this, again, this is in his forthcoming piece in the October issue of the Trumpet magazine. He says, Iran is pushing and pushing in its foreign policy. It's about to push so hard and so aggressively that it will launch a massive war, but it won't be with the United States, which is now too weak to even fight such a war. Instead, it will be against a new superpower with a fierce leader who will strike Iran and its radical Islamic allies like an overwhelming tornado. That's Daniel 11 and verse 40. That's the prophecy he bases that statement on. And then finally it says, the Bible specifically prophesied Iran's... You talk about all these prophecies given to Herbert Armstrong, understanding of these prophecies. My father added to that, the Bible specifically prophesied Iran's aggressive, terrorism-empowered foreign policy. It prophesied Europe's need for a strong leader. It prophesied Islam's clash with Catholic Europe. It prophesied America's shameful weakness. It prophesied that our people's sins are leading directly to weapons of mass destruction striking our populations. It says, through the pages of the Bible, God revealed these prophecies to a man who died on January 16th, 1986. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us at td@kpcg.com. Relevant.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily.
On yesterday's program, we talked about the importance, the crucial importance of the father's role in the home, the father's role in the family, and of course the father's role in God's purpose for man, God reproducing himself. We noted that verse in particular, 1 Timothy, where Paul said that fathers should rule the family well. They should rule the family well. And following that, we looked at a couple of examples just showing how that children need that instruction and that discipline coming from the father, because they need to be restrained. They need to have boundaries. Well, following on that from yesterday, if you look at the fifth commandment, the bridge commandment, it's been called, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the eternal your God gives you. That's the bridge between the two great commands that Jesus spoke of in Matthew 22. If you look at the Ten Commandments, the first four sum up an overall approach to life, an approach that puts God first in everything, upholding and esteeming God's position and office, God the Father, his office above all else, reverencing God and everything that he stands for. These first four commands, they're about honoring and fearing and loving God, our Father. And then with the fifth commandment, God commands children to reverence or to promote their parents, their physical parents. Now, this commandment flows right out of the spirit of the first four commandments, and it serves as the bridge between the two, love toward God and love toward fellow man. In our Ten Commandments booklet, it says here, the first commandment requires mankind to give honor to God's high office of authority as creator. The fifth commandment requires all men to honor the highest human office, that of parents. That's the highest human office, the parent's role. And of the two, the father. This commandment, speaking of the fifth, informs the bridge between the two great sections of God's law. We will never attain true spiritual and physical success without giving honor and obedience to God. And then it says, do we see that the same is true of our human parents? It's the key to success. Well, right there within the law itself, it says to children that your days may be long. that your days may be long upon the land which the Eternal your God gives you. How important is this concept, this principle, this law of honoring the Father? How important is the role of the Father? Going back to what I discussed again yesterday, well, coming at it from the other angle here today, let me switch over to The Plain Truth About Child Rearing. This is that old booklet that was produced in the Worldwide Church of God. But it makes a point here saying that the very first form of government with which the child comes in contact is government within the home. If there's no authority, no government in the home, how can the parents expect their children to respect the authorities and the governments in society? And it goes on to say that, you know, what, as far as a squirming infant is concerned, how does he or she view that parent? Well, it's like in the position of God. It's providing everything for that little infant. Food, shelter, protection. And it should be, anyway, providing godly instruction as well. Above all, that parent is the supreme authority in that little infant's life. It gave life to that infant. It provides for that infant. It protects that infant. And if it's a righteous father heading up that home, he's the infant's lawgiver and ruler. Rule your house well, Paul said to fathers. This child-rearing booklet, it says, if the child cannot have an orderly existence and cannot be kept within certain bounds, which he's made to understand, he becomes confused, frustrated. The parent who truly loves his children will want to discipline them in the right manner, at the right time, when they're doing things which will cause much greater hurt. A loving parent, you see, that's the way a loving parent thinks. Now, this responsibility, it does put, well, it's an awesome authority to have, and a tremendous responsibility comes with it, that we administer God's loving correction in the right way, that we don't abuse the authority, that we don't abuse children. But children need restraint. Children need to learn discipline. Children benefit or thrive in an environment that's structured, that's orderly. Of course, this should be common sense to people. For too many, though, today, as I said yesterday, the objective is to remove all restraint, to eliminate all the boundaries, and to just let young people roam and crash into one brick wall after another, and hope that, well, they'll finally learn their lesson before they become a hardened criminal. Why not train them up in the way they should go, as the Bible says? Look at what it says here in Hebrews 12. Turn over there and read it. Read it for yourself. Hebrews 12 and verse 5. It says, and have you forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto us as unto children? My son, despise not you the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. Don't despise correction. Don't despise the chastening when it comes from God. I mean, it's coming from God. It's a great blessing if it comes from God. For God to actually look into our lives and to see, this is something that needs to change. This is something I need to correct so that I can keep him on the right course, so that he can be protected or spared from a great collision down the road. What a joyful thing. It should be godly correction. It says, for whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. Did you get that? That's Hebrews 12 and verse 6. God punishes his children in love. God punishes his children because he loves them. That's a tremendous truth that's been forgotten by so many today, that God would take the time to dole out just and merciful chastisement, correction and rebuke. That says a lot about how much he cares about us about how much he loves us. Going back to that booklet, it says, true Christians today are recipients of God's just and merciful chastisement, his punishments and his admonitions, his corrections and rebukes, as well as his encouragement and comfort. He gives us all of that because of how much he loves us. Paul says here, Hebrews 12 and verse 7, it says, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chastens not? If you endure chastening, well, that means you're a son of God. It's the illegitimate ones that don't have a loving father there to administer chastening. Verse 8 says, but if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then you are bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we've had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? I mean, there was a time when, in you go back a few generations, when we revered fathers who corrected us. That's not so common today. But the point Paul is making is that if we can revere and honor a physical father who corrects us, how much more so the Father of spirits? Verse 10 says, speaking of human fathers, for they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure or according to their understanding, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. You see, God is reproducing himself. He's reproducing his character, his nature. And he knows what we need. He knows where we're headed. He knows if we're going in the wrong direction. And he knows how to get it right. Verse 11, now no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, after it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. I mean, it doesn't seem to be joyous at the start, but look at it long term. I mean, at the start, yes, it does hurt. Chastening hurts. Correction hurts. It's supposed to. It stings. But because it's coming from God, as this passage brings out, it's always for our own good. It's always for our learning. It's always for the development of godly character. And ultimately, I mean, if it's taken in a right attitude, God's chastisement leads to eternal life. This booklet says here, one of the very characteristics of a loving God is his nature of meting out just, merciful, and loving punishment when it is needed. And of course, God also comforts and encourages in time of need. That's the nature of our Father. And he's given us the challenging task, we fathers in the flesh. He's given us the responsibility to do the same, to mete out just and merciful and loving punishment to our children when it's needed. I mean, the largest chunk, as my father spelled out before, the 85% love, and together with it, the education, 10% or so, and then 5% of correction in love. But all of it together, 100% love. 100%. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and when we come back, we'll end with a couple of lighter stories that I think you'll find also to be very uplifting. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and you're listening to Stephen Fleury. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
U.S. Navy officers serenading a 98-year-old World War II veteran out there in California. I forget the city, but they showed up at his house thanking him for his contribution to their country. A 98-year-old World War II veteran, and if you have a chance, perhaps you can Google this, because if you see the video, here are these Navy officers out in the middle of the street in his neighborhood, and the 98-year-old man, he's out on his porch in full salute, standing erect with his head up to his forehead. And then all these officers after the fact coming up to shake his hand and to thank him for his service. So easy today. You see what's happening, particularly with America's leadership and the danger that America's leaders are putting the military in because of weakness, because there's no pride in the power of America. It's easy to focus in on so many of the negatives. But this was a moving moment. One of the few positives that you see with respect to the U.S. military today. The Telegraph says here, the officers sing Anchors Away, the march song of the U.S. Navy, at Ernest Thompson's home in California as he stands and salutes, the title being an incredibly moving moment with U.S. Navy officers singing to a 98-year-old veteran. Another uplifting story, this comes from the Olympics, which I guess concluded on Sunday, and you may have seen some reports on this, if not the footage itself, and it'll be a little hard to see this, given that it's radio, but if you listen, this is going on at the track and field facility there in Rio, and you can hear right away at the start of this clip the beginning of the U.S. national anthem, and I think it's about 5-10 seconds in, there's this U.S. pole vaulter who is right in the midst of his run as there's this ceremony for some other event that's playing off on the other side of the stadium, and then he hears the U.S. national anthem over the loudspeakers, and he's in a full sprint carrying this long pole, and he just screeches to a stop and drops the pole onto the ground, and then he immediately stands again in salute to the U.S. national flag And it's an interesting video to watch, too, just to see his reaction, to see how quickly he stopped. And then he's standing erect, but also looking around, trying to locate where the U.S. flag is. It's an amazing story. If you listen closely, as I say, 5 or 10 seconds in, I think you'll be able to hear when his feet come pounding to a rest and then the pole falls on the ground. So he was right in the middle of a run, and he stood there then for 2 minutes while the national anthem played, and it comes to the end of the song. And then once it was over, of course, the crowd, as it often does, just kind of then transitions from the end of the song into a long and lengthy applause. Well, as soon as the song's over, he hurriedly claps like 3 or 4 times, runs and gets his pole, and then gets back. I assume, I didn't see the rest of the footage after the fact, but he gets set for his run. And it says here from Fox Sports, United States Olympian and U.S. Army Second Lieutenant Sam Kendricks went as far as to stop running in the middle of a pole vault attempt to turn and salute the flag when he heard the Star Spangled Banner playing in the Olympic Stadium during a qualifying round. As I say, with all the headlines that you see, it's easy to focus in on some of the negatives. In fact, earlier in this same Olympics, there was some news made of, I think, one of the U.S. Gymnasts, a female gymnast, who wouldn't put her hand to her chest during the national anthem. Well, here was a case where not just any old athlete. It says later in this piece that Kendricks went on to win the bronze medal. I mean, he was in medal contention. And no doubt wondering, well, I wonder if I put myself in jeopardy here by not going through with this run. It's an incredible story in both of these cases, of respect and honor for those that have fought for America's freedoms, and respect and honor for the national anthem. A real story of patriotism. Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. Let me just roll through a few emails that have come in. This one here from Georgia. It says, I had to write as I had just come out of Staples when I started listening to your program of yesterday on my Google podcast, where you talked about your little painting episode. This is with the avocado. Why did I go into Staples, or what did I buy there? She says, a sketch pad. I had decided a couple of days ago to rekindle my youth sketching hobby from when I was in my late teens. I'll see how long I can keep it up. Pencil sketching is easier to do in those spare moments than painting. Thanks for posting your avocado on Twitter. It's not bad, she says. Mr. Churchill is such an inspiration. I thoroughly enjoyed his incredible use of language in describing how he got started with painting. And that is for sure. You can read that language, how he got started in painting, and see where he was also quite a skilled and accomplished painter. When it came to writing, he really did paint a beautiful picture with the words that he used. This one here, it says, my grandmother started attending WCG when my mother was about 14 years old. Though she never attended with any regularity, my mother always felt that it was the true church, and even requested that the Worldwide Church of God perform her marriage to my father, which they accommodated at the time in 1983. So here's a gal who listens in, whose grandmother started attending God's church many years ago, and whose mother was very familiar with the church, although didn't attend. And it says here, my mother has always supported and prayed for, since before my birth, my involvement with the church. She's been a believer and has wanted to follow through in many ways, but various things have kept her from doing so completely. She's always expressed a special kind of love for Mr. Armstrong, seeing him as a kind of father figure in a way. She states regularly that when he died, she thought, this is it, it's over. My grandmother and I both frequent the computer in my family's home at different times, checking up on God's websites, listening to programs. So my mother hears a fair bit today as she carries on many days. And just now, this listener writes, just now, as I sat listening to today's Trumpet Daily and you discussing the role of the father, this would have been yesterday's show, my mother stopped at my side and said, it's just amazing to me how much he always reminds me of Mr. Armstrong. We smiled and reminisced a bit, and when I said how nice it was to hear, she said, I know, it is wonderful. This is someone who's not in the true church of God, who says it just shows you that it doesn't matter who the messenger is, that it's God's message. And again, she said, when he died, I thought, this is it. However, this time, she added this, but then you see that God is still here. Indeed, he is. He's still here. The message is still here. God's work is still here. Mr. Armstrong's literature and message is still here. It's still here. Well, that's a nice way to end today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Send us those emails, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.